week we focus in on the fruit of joy. This language comes from Paul's letter to the Galatians, the fruit of joy. It's something that we have been exploring now for weeks together. We talked about love last week, and today we speak of the fruit of joy, how it should be present in the lives of those who claim to be baptized in the Spirit. Joy, like that fruit of love that we discussed last week, isn't always understood properly in our culture. A lot of times joy is set up as a synonym to happiness. And while on the outside joy and happiness may look a lot alike, on the inside, Paul would say that there is a profound difference. Happiness may be something that we can try to create for ourselves time to time. Maybe by eating a pack of Oreos, for example, that's given to you during a children's sermon, or maybe saving up and paying for that massage or that spa day that you've been looking forward to, or maybe it's getting that new toy that you get to ride around town on with your friends. Whatever it may be, these things that make you happy. Ah, but they do not bring about joy, because joy is something else entirely. The early church, especially those men and women who set their lives apart in deserts and in cloisters to live these lives of service to Jesus Christ, they often spoke of joy as being this result of friendship with God. That's the language they used, friendship with God. In order to befriend God, these men and women lived lives of incessant prayer. Prayer at work, even if it was doing the dishes. Prayer in solitude, prayer in silence, prayer in singing with their brothers and sisters in the daily hours, prayer at study. In this posture of prayer or openness to God, to joy, these holy ones believed that they were becoming friends with God, becoming friends with joy, and that through that relationship, they believed their hearts, their wills, their minds, their countenance would over time become synchronized with God's own heart, with joy's heart. Theodoret, a father of the church, put it this way: the friend of God despises everything else and looks at the beloved alone. That one puts serving God before all the rest and thinks only those things that please and serve the one he loves. Friendship. If we go back even earlier in our series and our time of preaching together, you will recall a place called Eden, which was known as the Garden of what? I had one person get it right this morning. I'm going to hope that the 10:45 service takes just as good notes. What is the Hebrew for Eden? The Garden of God's delight. It's the Garden of God's delight. Why was it called delight? Well, it was that place before the fall where humanity and God walked together day by day, minute by minute, in creation, all together and synchronized as one. And it is that image, that garden of delight, that we spend our lives on this side of Eden always trying to get back to. Friendship with God is delight, is joy. God still desires our friendship because, believe it or not, some of us don't really believe this some days, God very much delights in us, each and every single one of us. You are God's delight. A few weeks ago, I had the chance to go see the eclipse with one of my oldest friends. We go way back. We go back to fourth grade is when we really became close, when we were on a soccer team called the Shamrocks and went to elementary school at Rising Star and bonded one summer over riding our bikes on 87th Street between Lackman and Rose Hill Road almost every single day that summer, stopping off at the pool and then making our way up to Wind Wizards where we would buy Pogs. Anyone remember Pogs? Yeah, we'd use our babysitter money for that. I still have my Pogs. Are they worth anything? No, they're just pieces of cardboard? Yeah, that's what they are. Okay, so anyway, that was our bonding summer. And since then, we have been friends, even though it's been over a decade now since we've lived in the same state. She went off to New York City and has had a very successful career in finance. And, well, you know my story. It's the humble story of the scholar and the pastor. Does not have success in finance. But other than that, we are still good friends. So imagine my delight when she called up and said, hey, I'm coming into town for the totality of the eclipse. I've gotta be there. I'm going to be there. And we have an extra ticket. Will you come with us? And I said, of course I will. So I get ready that morning, bright and early, 6 a.m. I put on my uniform, which is usually, as my husband knows, a black dress or tunic and leggings. That's kind of all I wear. My mom's like, my daughter's like, why don't you wear pink? You always wear black. And I don't know, it's just easier that way, everything matches. So I get dressed and I grab a book. I grab a book to go in my purse because I don't know what traffic will be like. I don't know how long we're going to wait for this thing to happen. And I'm a dork and I always have a book handy. And I grab this book called Animal Vegetable Miracle by Barbara Kingsolver. Anyone read this? Okay, this will only prove to you the oddness of what's coming. All right, so I grab this book and I run over to Adrian's parents' house, the house that looks the same after 30 years, and Adrian comes running down the stairs, brushing her teeth, and wouldn't you know it, we're dressed in the same outfit, and everyone has a good laugh about that, and then we get, you know, loaded up, we get in the car, and we start driving. We don't drive. Adrian and I are in the back, and we each respectively reach into our purses to pull out a book to read. And what? Guess what? We have the same book in our purses. Like, this book came out years ago. It's not a new book. And we had the same hardback copy, and we just lost it in delight. The whole car, we just could not believe that even after so much time apart, we have this weird synchronization. Do you have people in your life like that? These friends that it's more than just surface level likeness. You're like in sync with them and in step with them. Friendships can bring this sort of reality apart, you know? Even friendship with God. Yesterday, I spent the day teaching preachers in rural areas of Missouri in the United Methodist Church about Paul. This is Opal's favorite person in the Bible. I was teaching them about Paul. I know, for 6 hours, Opal, we talked about Paul. Mostly me, but if my voice is tired, that's why. It's much to his disdain, I was not silent. So I taught about Paul. And, you know, Paul, we give him a hard time. But he goes through this range of emotions. He doesn't hide them well, but he really leverages them in his arguments and his letters that he's making at different churches. So you have a great contrast between the frustration and anger of Galatians and 1 Corinthians to the delight and the joy and the beauty of a letter like Philippians, which is one of my favorite pieces of scripture. Now I'm going to read some pieces from them, and I want you to tell me which one of those was written by Paul from a prison cell. Was it, you foolish Galatians? Who bewitched you? You were running well. Who prevented you from obeying the truth? Or is it, rejoice in the Lord always? Again, I will say, rejoice. Do not worry about anything, but in prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. You know the answer, right? Number two, it's not the angry letter written to a church at Galatia. It's the letter of joy that is written from the prison cell. The joyful music of Philippians composed in a cold prison cell. How can this be? Paul, from where he sits in that cell, I believe has found the road to joy. One way he gets there, I think, is by writing these letters to his friends, remembering them and recalling them and helping them to remember and recall Jesus, that source of joy. Because he knows that though he is suffering in that prison cell, he is aware that in those little churches and in those different towns, so many of his brothers and sisters are also suffering, are also being persecuted. But he knows that joy will keep their hearts in God and will bring about that peace that surpasses all of our understanding. And so I also think we see evidence not just of how much Paul has come to be a friend to his churches, but how Paul has become a friend of God. A deep and abiding friendship has been developed. He knows the secrets of the church mothers and fathers. He has drawn so close to God's heart that he is in sync with God's will for his life, no matter where it takes him. And knowing that and trusting in that, he has joy. The road to joy draws Paul home to God. Joy draws us back home to God. In a way, moments of happiness cannot always do. Because joy can settle in the heart and won't flee when times get tough in the way happiness can. In our text this morning from Isaiah, this prophet is remembering joy, recalling joy. And this message isn't coming from a great place of ease either. It comes from exile. Far from home and exile, from Jerusalem and the temple that housed God, that housed joy, where people would enter the gates with their joy and their thanksgiving to come home to God and worship. Oh, they're far, far, far away from there. And yet, Isaiah knows how to get them back home, even from where their feet stand, far away. And it's through relationship with God. It's through the language of recalling joy, painting a vivid picture of wilderness finding gladness, of a desert where there's no water blossoming, a place where all of these elements in nature that seem like an enemy to joy have no part. The lions and the jackals, the burning sand becomes cool, and the road to joy is clear. It's clear enough that even the fool, and I love this part, even the fool will not get lost, because the road to joy is before them and within them and within them. Isaiah, friend of God, caught a vision of what God desires for the people, God's beloved people. And this vision is joy in the midst of suffering, in the midst of what seems insurmountable circumstance to the outsider, to the one who is not a friend of God. I can almost hear Isaiah singing in in the throng of the exiles, under the watch of their captors, a song that would lead ultimately to their restoration. I've got the joy, 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 joy down in my heart. Down in my heart. Down in my heart. I've got the joy, 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 joy down in my heart. Yes, yes. You can hear it. You can hear it. What is our road to joy? Perhaps we can learn something from the happiest man in the world. Now, I know I've been saying joy, happiness, not the same thing. And the monk who's been given this title agrees. He hates the title. But scientists have claimed him as the happiest man in the world. This Tibetan monk, Matthieu Ricard, who for 12 years participated in a neuroscience study at the University of Wisconsin on meditation and compassion and its result on the mind. When scientists looked at this monk's brain, they saw something incredible. What did they see? What did joy do to the brain? Well, this is what they say. Quote, the scan showed that when meditating on compassion, Ricard's brain produces a level of gamma waves, those linked to consciousness, attention, learning, and memory, never reported in the neuroscience literature before. The scans also showed excessive activity in his brain's left prefrontal cortex compared to the right counterpart, allowing him an abnormally large capacity for happiness and a reduced propensity towards negativity. They literally looked at his brain for 12 years and saw it just was lit up like a Christmas tree. It was all light. And you can go online and Google this and see these images compared to most of our brains. It's all light. It's incredible. And Ricard insists that there is no secret power that he has, no secret way to changing his brain, only a habit that he picked up long ago, one that helps him not focus on himself, because Ricard noticed that the most unhappy people in his life only think about me, 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 me. And when you're thinking about me, 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 what happens when anyone else comes around? They might be a threat to me and my joy and my happiness. And he says that a life like that can just be exhausting and joyless. So he decided to do something else. And he said, whenever I see someone, whoever it is, I look at them, try to get them in the eye, and I wish them well. I don't say it out loud, but in my mind and in my heart, I am wishing them well. This person could be yelling at him. This person could be impatient and frustrated and doing whatever. And he is sitting there wiring his brain to wish him well, to wish him well. And at first it was hard. It was a battle because those judgments creep in. But after 12 years, it's not. It's a habit. And he goes through his days wishing well for all of his fellow creatures on earth, wishing well for them. It changed his mind, it changed his heart, and it changed his actions. Well, we aren't Tibetan monks, but I think that the monk is only saying something about somebody we do know. Because long before this monk did the practice of wishing well to people in his day, there was this fellow named Jesus who commanded over and over again to his disciples that you are to love your neighbor, that you are to love yourself, and so love God. And then there was also this pesky thing that was said about loving our enemies. And if that's not wishing them well, if that's not an activity of letting the light increase in ourselves, I don't know what else is. It causes joy. It causes joy. It causes joy because it connects us into the heart of joy. It makes us better friends to God, who is of that mind. God, who looks at all of you and everyone out there wishing well, because all are God's creatures and children, and God is always wishing well. The good work that has begun in you, oh, it's not over. God says there's more. There's more. Follow me. Be on this friendship journey with me, and you'll see even greater joy. I want to say one last thing about Paul, if that's okay, Opal, and that's something else that comes from Philippians. What is it that makes Paul's joy complete? Paul, who seems to have, in some ways, caught the mind of God from that prison cell. He says to his friends in Philippi, make my joy complete by being of the same mind, having the same love, being of full accord, not discord, and of one mind. And long before the happiest man in the world had his brain scanned, it was Paul from his prison cell who wrote, beloved, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is pleasing, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence and if there is anything worthy of praise, think about those things.